Welcome to the House Committee on Transportation Policy. Today is May 10th, 2017, and we are going to be opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 930. Senator Brzezinski.
Good morning, Mr. Vice Chair and committee members. Thank you very much for having me. Lloyd Brzezinski, State Senator, District 4. Senate Bill 930 is being brought to you through my office based on a news article that was in the Register Guard. It's part of the OLIS in the materials. It came out in January of this year, and it basically says EPD, meaning Eugene Police Department, warns keep garage door remote control, car registration away from thieves. The issue that we have before us is that we have a requirement that motor vehicle operators must keep in their vehicle or on their person their registration card for the vehicle itself as well as their insurance. And you will probably note if you look at your what you get in the registration card, it has your address, residential address, or if it's a business vehicle, the business address. But it also, many of the insurance forms that you get will, in fact, have that information as well. Some don't. It just depends on how the insurance company puts it together. The problem is that if you have someone that breaks into your vehicle and they have access to your glove compartment where most of us keep your registration card, they can not only take that out of your glove compartment, if you have a garage door opener, they can also take that, and guess what? They now know where you live. They now have a means to get into the garage, at least, to actually go into your house, or at least your garage, and let's say do more harm to you than what they just did to your vehicle. This is a situation that, when it came to my attention as a prosecutor, I said, why are we requiring that? So we worked with the Department of Transportation, and they brought to our attention two things. Number one, in their rules, that allows for an individual to actually black out that specific information. Mm-hmm. What I'm concerned with is that I didn't know that in my professional capacity, and I think most of us never realized that. So we felt on the Senate side it was time for to actually codify this into the statutes and not just rely on the rule. And it will cost us nothing. All this will be is basically a PSA informational program that we will just make certain that individuals who have vehicles, who have the registration, that they can in fact do this and that they should do that for their safety and protection. The last part of this that was kind of ironic, if you read that article, it was mentioned that you shouldn't keep these items of identification in your vehicle. You should keep them on your person. Now, we all know that in many of our lives, more than one individual will operate that vehicle. And how are you going to do the trade-off as to the registration card? So here before you is a bill that we hope will be a simple fix, an education that we can give to our constituents that they can, in fact, take reasonable steps of protecting themselves by blacking out that identification information. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions? Well, yes.
No, the great idea. I mean, if you don't think like a criminal, you know, you these things don't come up. So thank you for thinking like a criminal.
You bet. All part of the job.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator, very much. All right. Okay, well, then I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 930. And now we'll open up the informational meeting on autonomous vehicles. And I'd like to call up our first panel, which will be the technical experts, we'll call them, the Travis Brower, Alan Douglas, and Art Pierce. Please all come up and then make sure you, depending on who goes first, state your name for the record. And yes, sir, Vice Chair.
But before the panel begins, Vice Chair Meek, I think maybe Brett McLean and I should take just a moment to explain the purpose of this informational hearing and kind of what we expect may happen after this hearing over the next couple of weeks or months. We all know that the coming of driverless vehicles is accelerating and that the fears and concerns surrounding that are many. Today, I'm really hoping that what we can do is develop a very comprehensive set of questions that those who assist us on the work group over the next few weeks and months will be able to work out. Questions that not only relate to the testing, but I think more importantly, the actual deployment of these vehicles in the future, which, as we are hearing, may be a very near future or much more near than we may have anticipated. And so the folks that we've asked to come today for this informational hearing are a core group, hopefully, that will be able to deliver not necessarily the answers, but a full range of the questions that we can address in the future. Mm-hmm. Anything you want to add, Susan?
The only thing that I would add, Mr. Chair and Representative Vial, is I really want to thank everybody who came today, because it was on a fairly short notice, and folks were really good about really kind of pulling together and providing us with some really pretty wonderful experts in the room today. So thank you very much, and I look forward to the questions and the comments and the thoughts and ideas.
And I would urge members of the committee to help us with this and really formulate some good questions that we might be able to develop as we go along. Thank you, Representative Meek.
No, thank you, Vice Chair Vial. Okay, yes, Mr. Brower, you'd like to start?
Yes. I'd be happy to. Chair Meek, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Travis Brower, the Assistant Director of ODOT. I was here actually about a month or so ago talking about automated vehicles when you had a bill up in front of the committee. And so I'm back today. You've asked me to talk about a couple of things. One is the work that's going on within ODOT, particularly our connected automated vehicle steering team, and then also to provide some background on the federal automated vehicles policy that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, or NHTSA, has promulgated. So first, a little bit of background. We see the reality that automated vehicles are coming, and they will be transformational for the transportation system. Much like the transition from the horse and buggy to the internal combustion engine or to the fully connected interstate system fundamentally transformed our transportation system and our communities, automated vehicles will be a transformational technology that will change everything about our transportation system. And for ODOT, they'll change everything about how we do business, from how we build roads to how we license drivers and register vehicles. There are a variety of levels of automation that are defined by the Society of Automotive Engineers, a standard-setting body. When we're talking about automated vehicles today, we're going to be talking about the highly automated vehicles, those in the green section of this chart, where the computer systems monitor the environment rather than a human. So, for example, level 3 are cars that can operate on automated mode for some of the time in certain conditions, but then may fall back into full human drivers. Level 5 automation is where you have a driver that is not even really present in the vehicle. There may not even be a steering wheel or pedals. A key distinction in this area is between testing and deployment. When we talk about automated vehicle testing, we're talking about a small number of vehicles that will be operated by trained test drivers. And in this area, there's be relatively limited risk, so we can have a relatively light touch from a regulatory perspective. When we talk about commercial deployment, we are talking about wide-scale deployment of these vehicles on the road. And clearly, we will need to have a more in-depth regulatory framework. ODOT has seen automated vehicles coming for the last few years, and we have been engaging in this given our leadership role in transportation safety and mobility. We have taken steps to address automated vehicles, starting with creating a policy framework and then hiring a connected automated vehicle policy advisor and creating an internal connected and automated vehicle steering team. ODOT has a number of divisions that in many states are actually separate agencies. So we have a DMV that is part of ODOT, a motor carrier transportation division, a safety division, a highway division. All of these play a key role in connected and automated vehicles. And so we brought them together in a steering team along with the Oregon State Police, because they are another key factor in transportation safety. We created this group about 2 years ago, and they have been doing things like monitoring the new technology and the implications for the agency and the transportation system, recommending policy approaches that we should take on connected vehicles and automated vehicles, building relationships with external stakeholders, refining a voluntary notification process for those who wish to test these on our streets, and then tracking progress of internal and external research efforts related to connected and automated vehicles. Last September, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration released a federal automated vehicles policy. It's key to distinguish the roles and responsibilities between the federal government and the state government. The federal government is in charge of setting safety standards for vehicles, things like airbags, seat belts, and in this case, automated vehicle technology. The state's role is to ensure the proper operation of vehicles through traffic laws, licensing, and insurance requirements. In Oregon, the current state law does not really provide state agencies any authority to sanction or prohibit automated vehicle testing in Oregon. Our preliminary review of the motor vehicle code is that essentially if you have a licensed driver behind the wheel, even if they are not driving the vehicle, that it does not necessarily violate state traffic laws. What the federal government did in promulgating this policy was provide some instructions to states to consider when examining automated vehicles. They really want to promote a consistent approach to automated vehicle testing across jurisdictions. And we believe this is a strong starting point that provides some guidance for the states. There were a number of key recommendations for states that came out of this. They recommended that each state establish a lead agency responsible for overseeing automated vehicle testing within the state. They also recommended the creation within each state of a multi-agency committee that, since the federal government only can come up with awful acronyms, is known as the JASTIC, or the Jurisdictional Automated Safety Technology Committee. As envisioned in the NHTSA guidance, this would include representatives from the state, Department of Transportation, the governor's office, the state police, Department of Justice, state insurance regulators, and those representing state agencies for aging and disabled people, as well as representatives from local jurisdictions. We have not formed a JASTIC here in Oregon, but we envision that there are a number of goals that the JASTIC could accomplish. First, it could educate state agencies on the automated vehicle landscape to make sure they're all moving in the same direction. Second, it could coordinate with other jurisdictions at the local level and track the progress of developments nationwide. And third, it would advise on implementation of a temporary automated vehicle testing pilot. The other aspect that NHTSA recommended in its framework is that each state should create a regulatory framework within the state. That would involve looking at each state's laws and regulations in the areas of licensing and registration, driver education and training, insurance and liability, enforcement of traffic laws and regulations, and administration of motor vehicle inspections in order to ensure that those were strong, but also to ensure that there were not unnecessary barriers to safe testing, deployment, and operation of automated vehicles. And they recommend that each state develop a process that includes an application and permit issuance process for manufacturers to test in the jurisdiction. Currently, we do not have that authority, and so ODOT is doing that as a voluntary notification process in which we collaborate with the state police when we receive that notification from testers. So in conclusion, ODOT recognizes the transformative potential for automated vehicles in the areas of safety, mobility, and the transformations that will occur in our communities and our economy as a result of these technologies. We are stepping up to prepare for and adapt to our transportation system and our agency for automated vehicles, and we stand ready to assist the legislature as you look at how the state should address this brave new world of automated vehicles.
Chair Meek, should we hold questions until all three of the panelists have spoken?
Sure.
That'd be all right.
We can keep that. You guys will be the technical experts. Okay, thank you. Mr. Douglas? Or Mr. Pierce? Yeah. Either way, you're in charge. I was going on the list of the...
Oh. Vice Chair Meek, members of the committee, thank you. Good morning. Slides. Should we change places here?
Yes.
Okay.
Unless you want me to go.
Unless you, if you had an order for...
I can go too, you know, whatever works.
You go. Yes.
I'll just go. All right, there we go. All right.
Musical chairs there.
Musical chairs. All right. So good morning. My name is Art Pierce. I manage transportation policy, planning, and projects for the City of Portland. And so we are also sort of new members to this community who's considering autonomous vehicles. So thank you for the opportunity to talk with you this morning. So I think one of the key questions, of course, is what's the role of cities? Why have a city in this conversation? And I think one of the key considerations to remember is cities are where our roadways are most there's the most competition for space. It's where citizens, in terms of as pedestrians, as cyclists, and as transit riders, will interact and continue to interact with motor vehicles. So the use of the right of way, differentiated from the specific safety standards for the vehicles, is really the role of cities to determine how the roads will continue to be used and how it will serve our citizens best. For those that have families and like family movies, a lot of people have been talking about whether or not the movie WALL-E may be a future representation of what transportation might look like. And one of the key messages that I certainly received out of WALL-E, among others, was that if you're thinking about the health of people, we now have a pretty common understanding that 10,000 steps a day is what it takes to keep the human body vital and alive. If the future is one that is envisioned within the WALL-E movie, we're going to need to hook up to exercise machines at the end of the day to make sure that they stay alive and healthy. And so there's a future issue around just the health of the human body and the health of society depending on how we incorporate new technology into our lives. One of the other sort of basic rules is one of geometry. And so if we're thinking about congestion, particularly in the Portland region, which I know this committee has been spending a lot of time thinking about, making sure that we're thinking about the space we're using within the right-of-way and how we can use that space most efficiently is a really key consideration in cities. And so the graphic to the right shows the utilization of a single person driving a single car, the utilization of that same right-of-way with an Uber driver driving a single person in the back seat, and the utilization of that same right-of-way when we have an autonomous vehicle, no human driver, driving a single person in the back seat. And you'll see that we have not changed the efficiency of how we're using the roadway system, and so we will not be addressing congestion unless we are figuring out how to have those vehicles be shared by more than one passenger. One of the other great complexities of the urban environment, of course, is parking, right? And parking is a major land use in within cities. It is also one of very competitive use of space, right? And so there's actually great promise from autonomous vehicles in terms of not needing to park as many vehicles because those vehicles might be able to be shared or not need to park. One of the challenges that might come with that is if you are able to, as you're in this meeting today, tell your autonomous vehicle to walk itself around the block for a couple hours, that car is competing for use with other people who are trying to get to meetings and go from place to place. So even though you're not experiencing the congestion on the roadway, your car may be. And so there's some important balancing acts considering the benefits of parking but the challenges of inefficient use of the roadway system. One of the other challenges in the Portland region is who's bearing the cost of transportation, right? So we have an imbalance, really, in the Portland region around the share of household income that's expended against transportation, particularly in East Portland and North Portland. And so thinking about how the incorporation of autonomous vehicles can help reduce everyone's cost of their transportation as they're within their budget and help balance out some of that imbalance is another key consideration that we would want to be aware of. The other piece is how do we create a great place? So this is a literal postcard from Portland from the 1950s or 60s that the message from Portland was be careful crossing the street in Portland. That was the brand of Portland at that time, which is certainly not the brand we think of now. When we think about the image on the right, that is an image that is a multimodal transportation system that incorporates transit users, pedestrians, cyclists, small business, all these things. Thinking about how autonomous vehicles can be as a new technology that really is agnostic to how it might drop into the urban environment, deployed in a way that supports all these types of goals is a key element that we want to be considering when we're thinking about how to regulate and direct the use of the streets. So in terms of potential promise, this is a graphic on the right. Is an actual autonomous vehicle that is beginning to deploy in some areas. And this is a first last mile transit shuttle. So this is connecting to a light rail system or some kind of transit system, or running through a university campus, can hold 12 passengers and run on a fixed route or on the demand route. So there's a lot of potential we can see, certainly in an urban environment, for this type of autonomous vehicle to help with a lot of those transportation needs. And so I think we really believe that there's the potential for safety gains, benefits for congestion, climate pollution, and even a lot of benefits for freight movement. And some of those we're already seeing today with Daimler within Oregon making some great innovations. There also are a lot of challenges, and I think that's why this committee is so aptly paying attention to this with great focus, is that as we're looking at incorporating a new technology and the new use of the right-of-way, there's a lot of implications for how that would happen, and setting the right policy course and really asking the right questions will be essential to getting the outcomes we want to see. In the near term, one of the key elements is making sure that the technology is ready for the urban environment. One of the big challenges is that there's a lot of sort of quick movements happening in the can you tell if a person is standing at an intersection ready to cross, or just standing at an intersection waiting for a friend? We can make some cues, judgments as humans. It's very hard at this point for the technology to make some of those assessments. So there's a lot of implications within the urban environment. And one of the other challenges I already raised was around empty miles. So if we have these empty autonomous vehicles that are circulating about but aren't performing a transportation function per se, that's not a very good use of our roadway system. And so thinking about ways to stress that and make sure that there's a penalty for that kind of usage would be very important. And again, health and equity that I already touched on a little bit. One of the other challenges to think about is how our funding will need to shift. I think Oregon is a leader with our VMT pilot, but this is the type of moves that we're going to need to continue to make if we're primarily funded through gas tax and through parking regulation, and we have hopefully electric vehicles that don't need to park as much. We have a structural problem for a lot of our funding, right? So we really need to be thinking about how, over the course of these years, we're thinking about funding in concert with the technology. And then one of the great challenges, of course, is that jobs, one of the primary position classifications within the U.S. is that of a driver. So if we need less drivers, what are we training the next generation of folks who have a high school degree and this driver was a good position for them previously? What do we bring them into to make sure that they are a vital part of the economy? So for Portland, we have a very strong policy direction set through our comprehensive plan and our transportation system plan that helps us to understand the key things that we want to see in terms of supporting great places, great communities, making sure that we're addressing Vision Zero and equity, continuing to address congestion and climate. And one of the key acronyms that we think really helps represent overall is, and a lot of cities are talking about FAVES, so Fleet Autonomous Vehicles that are electric and shared, captures a lot of elements, we think, of what will make autonomous vehicles really supportive and successful in cities. So we think that's a good thing for everyone to keep in mind, that there's a model there. A couple key actions, one of which related to that hearing that you had last month. So Portland sent a letter to the legislature, to this committee, around autonomous vehicles, and I'll share a copy of that again in case you don't have it handy. Specifically saying that we need to not allow for preemption, that states and local jurisdictions have a very important and vital role in helping to incorporate autonomous vehicles, as we are, as a supportive jurisdiction, wanting to see them coming and testing and deploying in Portland over time. Also, the really important step of making sure that we're sharing information and requiring that the testing and deployment of vehicles includes the registration step. So that's very, very important for us to be able to know who's using the streets and to know how that is impacting the streets environment so that we can adjust the expenditure of infrastructure and other policy moves. Finally, just a couple weeks ago, our mayor and transportation commissioner announced a proactive approach to incorporating autonomous vehicles into Portland's environment. So through a press event on April 19th, we announced four steps that we will be taking between now and mid-June to begin charting a course and proactively asserting how we think autonomous vehicles can come into the Portland environment and help us. So one key element, we're finalizing an interim policy that we will bring before City Council that really stresses those policy outcomes that we want to see incorporated into the proposal. We're issuing a request for interest, essentially, a request for information by mid-June to have essentially an open door to technology providers, vehicle manufacturers, and other players so we can understand how they might want to partner with us to begin with that testing environment. And then beginning an admin rule process to be able to make sure that they understand how they can interact with the city. Where is the door? What information that needs to be provided so it's not ambiguous about how that process should happen? And then the last is making sure that we're incorporating the concerns and questions of the public and answering those effectively as we're doing so. So thank you.
Thank you. And we're holding questions still. We'll keep writing them down if you have any. And then Mr. Douglas.
Get out of here. Oh, she's doing it.
Thank you, Vice Chair Meek, members of the committee.
Your name, sir.
My name is Alan Douglas. I'm a professor. I work for Oregon Institute of Technology, or Oregon Tech. My particular area of expertise is electrical engineering and renewable energy. I'm also the specialty director for the Masters of Engineering in Embedded Systems and Interconnected Devices at Oregon Tech. We're currently working on the program. We're about to roll out the master's degree. It will start this fall. My particular area of expertise technically is advanced digital design. It says microcontrollers, microprocessors, and embedded systems, which are obviously very applicable to automated vehicles. I have a master's degree from Oregon State in electrical engineering, 1993. Just wanted to kind of introduce you to myself so that you understand my credentials in this particular area. 24 years of industry experience. I've founded a couple of different design and consulting firms. I currently work as a lead engineer. It doesn't call the company here, but I work for FLIR Systems. I'm the electrical engineering manager there and a lead designer. And some of our airborne products focus on visual and infrared camera systems, both or all three shortwave, medium wave, and long wave infrared systems, image processing, laser rangefinders, and GPS, and so forth. So a lot of technology here that I'm very familiar with that we use all the time in product development that's directly applicable to automated vehicles. At Oregon Tech, we have expertise in our faculty, both in the EERE department, Electrical Engineering Renewable Energy, as well as our Computer Systems Engineering department. We're currently partnering, just as an example, with a company called Cure Avionics here in Oregon to develop an embedded system that uses infrared cameras, particularly shortwave infrared cameras, to assist in aircraft landing under foggy conditions, which would be directly applicable to managing autonomous vehicles in different kinds of environmental conditions. And just so that you're aware, you know, one of our main goals as far as our Masters of Engineering program focused on embedded systems, we really want to help our graduates address the needs of the industry as this new industry emerges. So I wasn't quite sure exactly what kind of information you were looking for in this meeting here today. And so there were sort of two items that were brought to my attention. One was just understanding basically how the technology works and then what issues would be required to be addressed by the committee to form an effective policy here. I'm going to primarily focus on the first item, and I hope that the technical information that I'll provide you may be beneficial and helpful in the future. So I just want to start at a very high level. When we think about computers and embedded computing platforms, which is my area of specialty, I want to make sure that we're clear. We have sort of general purpose computers, PCs, laptops, desktops, tablets that we're all very familiar with, general purpose running third-party software and a wide variety of applications. Then we have sort of the server space where we're talking about cloud computing and things like that. And then the third category is really embedded computers, and that's the area of my specialty. Embedded computers are focused on a particular type of application with a particular set of sensors and actuators to control that system. And so they're not nearly, you know, the sort of flexible computers that we're all used to. They're a very dedicated application. Some examples of those applications include modern automobiles. We all have computers in our cars these days, smart TVs, Blu-ray players, and so forth, autopilot systems for aircraft, industrial automation, Internet of Things, and, of course, autonomous vehicles. So that'll be a big application going forward. So some of the challenges for embedded system development. It's a very multidisciplinary industry, and that's why we've formed a Master's of Science in Engineering as a broad multidisciplinary master's degree program, which can incorporate hardware, software, data analytics, and things like that all within the same program. These applications require lots of different sensors, lots of different actuators, and different software protocols, so it becomes very complex to put the whole system together. All embedded systems really require a very rugged environment. They deal with extreme temperatures, shock, vibration. They have to have very high reliability. And, of course, in autonomous vehicles, that's a paramount concern. They have to have small footprint, real-time processing, network connectivity. So we need to have devices and in our automated vehicles that are all networked together so that the cars can communicate and communicate with the network for changing traffic patterns and so forth, as well as having a strong emphasis on encryption, authentication, and security once all of our cars are networked and all connected together. This is a figure that I got from The Economist, and I just wanted to use this as a talking point because it sort of illustrates technically how you put together an autonomous car. You might have various radar systems here in the car, as well as forward-looking cameras. They are video cameras of different wavelengths, as I mentioned. Infrared is quite a quite interesting technology for this type of application, as well as LIDAR, which are lasers that can scan the environment in 360 degrees and use the flight time of a laser to determine ranges and distances to all kinds of objects all around the car as it's driving. All of this would be controlled by a central computer inside the car, which is the embedded application that we're talking about. So many different sensors that need to be integrated together, and then very sophisticated software to analyze all of this data coming into the vehicle to do collision avoidance and to control the direction and speed of the vehicle. We've already talked about earlier today the different levels that the SAE has established. So we go all the way from level zero all the way to level five, which is, you know, no human intervention is required at all. This is the self-driving taxi cab that has been mentioned earlier. This is really kind of the holy grail that all the technology companies would really like to be able to reach. And it's quite a stretch, but you can see the different levels. And just to kind of illustrate a couple things, when you think about like level one, hands-on, the driver is still engaged. Level two, hands-off, the vehicle kind of drives itself, but you're still right there behind the wheel, able to take control if need be. Level three, eyes off, now you can get on the internet and browse your phone and so forth. Mind off, where you're really not even, you know, particularly engaged in the driving and operation of the vehicle, but can take control if necessary. And then, of course, level five, where the vehicle can drive itself. So I want to talk a little bit about technical challenges to help you understand what we in the technology industry are facing and challenges to try to develop automated vehicles like this. Technical challenges, I kind of rank this in three different levels. Technical challenges, difficult technical challenges, and what I would classify as very difficult technical challenges. Just sort of how things become more and more complex as you look at trying to reach that level five of automation. So, you know, the things that we can do today, navigation via GPS and traffic congestion information, when the vehicles are all networked together, we can certainly share that information. We have very high bandwidth requirements for all of the cameras. We're talking about high-definition cameras, LIDARs, radars, all this data. We can collect all of that data. We can handle that kind of bandwidth today. We can control things like the speed, direction, and do diagnostics as the vehicle is in motion. Some of the more challenging things are sensing traffic boundaries. We talked about, you know, finding, you know, pedestrians on the side of the road. Are they looking to move across the road, or are they just standing there waiting for a friend and so forth? Maintaining lane position. That was something that came up when I was invited to this. How does a vehicle maintain a lane position? That can be done today. We have, you know, technology today that when you begin to drift outside of the lane, you'll get warnings and notification. That can be done and is being done today. Operation in non-ideal weather conditions, like I mentioned, fog, rain, snow, those kinds of things, become much more difficult for an autonomous vehicle to navigate the terrain. And then, of course, we have the challenges of enhanced network security. We're pretty good with our encryption these days, but it is still a challenge to be able to do that in a wireless networked environment. We get to the very difficult things. Now, when we talk about computer programming that is going to be used in embedded systems like this, this isn't your conventional kind of computer programming or saying, you know, if I sense an obstacle, well, then let's change lane. It's not this sort of if-then kind of conventional computing that we often think about. Now we're talking about machine learning. We're talking about neural networks, things like that, where the system actually has to be trained in order to learn what the environment looks like. If you think about some modern video games like the Kinect, They used tens of thousands of different human subjects in front of this system to be able to identify where your head is, where your arms and limbs are, and they trained the system with all these different samples and test cases in order to be able to recognize anyone who should happen to step in front of the video game. Now, this is a video game. It doesn't have to be that accurate, but we're talking about automated vehicles here where lives and property are at stake, so this has to be done very rigorously as we move towards that level 5. So some of the computational hardware and software applications will need to be able to do graphics processing, rapid object recognition. This is an area that I'm particularly interested in, where we're differentiating, say, between a tool that's fallen off a flatbed truck on the highway when we're going at 55 miles an hour, and you and I are going to have a certain reaction to this, or maybe a pothole, or the remains of a tire that is ruptured on the highway. We're going to have a certain reaction to that. The self-driving car or automated car is going to have to be able to not only recognize that there is an object there in the lane, and how fast we're approaching it, but have to be able to recognize what is that object and what's the appropriate course of action. If a tool falls off a flatbed truck, I'm going to have a very different reaction than if a piece of styrofoam or a plastic bag is blowing across the highway. We need to make sure that our computational systems are capable of recognizing and differentiating different kinds of obstacles. Also, when we're talking about high speed, we need to not only worry about, say, object avoidance in terms of stationary objects, but now everything's dynamic, everything's in motion, and we have to be able to anticipate location of different vehicles or hazards that we need to avoid, as well as project their velocity and whether or not impact is imminent or not. So it becomes much more difficult when we're moving at high speeds and we have lots of different other moving objects in a changing environment. Clearly, this system not only has to be able to acquire the data from all of these sensors, be able to do object recognition, and then also be able to make rapid decisions that are sometimes could be ethical in nature in terms of how do you minimize the damage or minimize the potential for the loss or of human life or human damage. I don't want my autonomous vehicle, for instance, in that situation where a bag blows across the highway to slam on the brakes, for instance. That's something that clearly we would all be concerned about. So very difficult technical challenges to overcome. You can think about the sort of evolution of this technology in general. We have things like adaptive cruise control today, collision avoidance systems like radar, LIDAR, image recognition. FLIR has deployed infrared systems with forward-looking cameras today for sort of a driver assist, where you can see in the night if a deer were to jump in front of the road, the driver can see that, where you can't even see it necessarily with high beams on in your car. And so we've deployed systems like this, automated parking systems we've seen and do exist, lane departure warning systems that I mentioned, they do exist. But you can see the technology is evolving, and it typically takes, 5 to 10 years before it's widely available. Even things like, the cruise control or anti-lock brakes in your vehicle took time to for these technologies to be adopted and then widely distributed within the industry. You're looking, 5 to 10 years out. You would see more and more advanced features as we, as the public, begin to get greater and greater trust for these kinds of computer-controlled assistance and features in our vehicles. If you look at the industry overall and look at the different players in the industry, they're really pushing the technology aggressively. They really want to jump forward. And if you kind of extrapolate from where we are now, as it says in the slide here, you could look at, the 5, 10, maybe even 13 years up to 2030 kind of time frame for how this technology is going to roll out. But I have a couple of quotes here from some of the leaders in the industry, particularly like companies like Daimler that's partnered with Bosch. They're looking, they're saying start of the next decade, so 2020 type time frame. So they're very aggressive about it. Then you look at companies, say, Mercedes-Benz and things like that. Recently, they said, driverless taxis, which is what we're talking about at sort of the level 5, where this vehicle can navigate itself, can park itself, can pick passengers up, and requires no driver intervention at all. They're saying at least a decade away. So I wanted to give you a sense of time frame and urgency here. So maybe by 2027. But you know, that's the kind of general time frame that we're thinking about in terms of these vehicles and when we will actually see them being deployed. So that gives you a...
Mr. Douglas, yes. How many more slides do you have left?
This is it.
Okay,
is
great. I just want to leave room for time for questions, and then we have another two panels.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you very much. That concludes my presentation today.
Thank you very much. Okay. Well, it looks like Vice Chair Vial has some questions.
Okay. You want to go ahead?
No, we're not going to ask.
I do. I have a few questions, and I'm going to start with Mr. Douglas. Do you expect that there will be an appropriate deployment without it being essentially nationwide? In other words, does the technology really need to be something that is consistently acceptable to all jurisdictions before we're going to see truly driverless cars?
No, I don't necessarily think so. I think, you know, different states, different cities are going to be deploying infrastructure at different rates. And so I think each different jurisdiction is going to have to decide how they want to handle that and at what, you know, rate they are ready to roll out the technology, what rate they're willing to invest in the infrastructure that's required to support autonomous vehicles.
So, Mr. Pierce, you made a comment about the idea that we've got to avoid local preemption, but I'm still grappling with the idea of if we really allow cars to transverse jurisdictions without any turnpikes anymore, and so without any way to stop them from going from one jurisdiction to another. Is it really going to be appropriate for one jurisdiction to allow deployment where all jurisdictions haven't maybe come on board at that point?
Well, I think that's part of the benefit of having a statewide conversation, which we really welcome being a part of. I think a lot of what we expect, because Portland and other cities already regulate the use of the right-of-way, so regulating through our city engineer standards, speeds, for instance, on some of our local streets, or parking regulations, those kind of things, that it's appropriate for the city to directly engage in these conversations. Really, in the near term, what we expect is near-term testing, initial piloting. So we've got a number of years of sort of incremental steps as we, I think, understand what the broader landscape looks like. But I think it is possible that specifically some of the pilots that we're seeing, Contra Costa County down in California, for instance, is running some of those autonomous buses within an institutional campus environment. You know, there's examples where I think there's sort of small-scale deployments, connections to our MAX system that might really help in an area where there's inadequate sidewalk infrastructure or other challenges to the streets, that we may see really small-scale use for a number of years as we're better understanding the technology, but helping to demonstrate how it can really help to benefit some of our citizens.
Yeah. And then one final one, Vice Chair Meek. Going back to Mr. Brower's presentation, who really should be the entity that decides whether a particular vehicle has sufficient technology to allow it to be on the road?
Yeah. Chair Meek, Vice Chair Vial, in general, what we're talking about is that there will be different levels or different responsibilities at different levels of government. And for the most part, it will be the federal government that sets the vehicle technology safety standards, just as they do today around airbags or braking systems or other vehicle technologies. And then the state's role will be more in those areas of driver education and training, licensing, insurance, and traffic laws. And then there will be an appropriate role for local governments to play in this as well. So in general, we would not want the state to be assigned any significant role in reviewing the engineering of vehicles. That is not our expertise. That is why we have a National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and a federal government to do that work.
Thank you.
Yes. Just one second. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Meek. Just a question on speed limits and destinations. I know we're early on here, but who will match the actual speed the vehicle goes to the posted limit? Will one ever be able to exceed the speed limit in an autonomous car?
Well, I'm assuming you're addressing me?
Yes.
That these cars, as they are envisioned, once they are deployed, say on the highways, that kind of thing, would be highly networked together. And this is an autonomous vehicle all under computer control, so control of the speed limit would be set by the software. It would not be something that we would be able to interfere with. The speed limits would be set by that. Furthermore, the cars would be in communication with one another. So the idea is that you wouldn't have to have as much distance between the vehicles. If there is an object that's detected or some sort of issue with roads, they would all communicate at speeds higher than human reaction times and be able to slow down as a group rather than have them sort of back up the way they do today with the delayed response of our human response time. So as far as controlling the speed, that would be set with the software and how the vehicle is operated within that environment. One other thing I wanted to mention is there's a concept called geofencing, where the vehicle knows exactly where it is within with a GPS system, so it knows what the speed limits are in those particular areas. We also would be able to determine when they cross a boundary in geofencing, where if they went from one jurisdiction to another, that would be automatically detected by the vehicle. So that it sort of addresses some of the earlier questions, I think.
Yeah, but I just have a follow-up on that then. Mm-hmm. As far as where an autonomous vehicle is allowed to go, mm-hmm. do you see any situation where one driving or one being a passenger or whatever in an autonomous vehicle would not be able to go into certain jurisdictions with that vehicle?
Certainly that could be implemented technically. Yes, you could actually say, for instance, the sort of university campus kind of environment, that could be geofenced, so the vehicle cannot move outside of that zone without going under human direct control of the vehicle. And that could be signaled, and a vehicle could automatically pull to the side of the road and allow the sort of change of mode. So instead of, say, running at level 5 where it's fully autonomous, once it crosses this geofence boundary, now it requires human direct control of the vehicle.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Representative McLean?
No. I want.
Sure. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With announced and impending changes in national health care, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Labor, to name but just a few, I hope that our State Department of Transportation will be prepared to step in should the need arise.
Chair Meek, Representative Witt, certainly we are prepared to engage the federal government in these areas and will be monitoring as we see within the current administration that the existing federal automated vehicles policy, I think, will be under review. They'll be looking to modify, and we will be engaging in all of these discussions at the federal level.
Thank you. And then Representative McLean.
Hi. One of the things that you mentioned right at the end, this it takes time to roll out, how you're able to put the parameters in the sort of the atmosphere that the car's in. And so nobody's talked yet about the fact that there's not going to be just all autonomous vehicles immediately. And so we're going to be dealing with a variety of drivers, a variety of cars, and a variety of landscape. So I wondered if any of you had any thoughts about some of the challenges there I get the technical part. Mm-hmm. You can put up a fence. Mm-hmm. Tell them it can't go there without, this, that, or the other thing. But what are some of the challenges as far as dealing with this very different atmosphere that's not all technical?
Well, Chair Meek, Representative McLean. In my opinion, this is one of the things that makes the machine learning so incredibly important, because as we know, this technology is going to evolve towards this level 5 that we continue to talk about, where we have a fully autonomous vehicle. But we recognize that even when we get to that level, there will still be conventional cars on the road. And during this whole evolutionary process, we need to be able to deal with this sort of mix of the environment. And one way to do that is to constrain, say, autonomous vehicles to particular lanes or particular routes or particular geographic areas. We've discussed address that as well. But the reality of it is you're going to have environments where autonomous vehicles and conventional vehicles are in a mixed situation. That's why I think the machine learning is so incredibly difficult and such a great opportunity for technological development. Because as you deal with, particularly at reasonable speeds that we all drive today, we have to deal with a nearly an infinite number of different kinds of situations where it requires us to make decisions on the road. Having conventional vehicles in that same environment with autonomous vehicles is just more cases for us to have to deal with. People that cut you off, for instance, those kinds of things. The autonomous vehicle at level 5 has to be able to deal with those kinds of situations. And so being able to mix the technology is very challenging. But before we can ever really get to level 5, we have to be able to accomplish that anyway. So I do think that it's going to be possible to have both types of vehicles simultaneously occupying the same routes.
Thank you, Mr. Douglas. And then Representative Evans.
Yeah, I have a comment and then a question. Actually, two comments on the question. The first is, while, again, I know people are excited about technology, I'm not one of those people, but I know that people that are excited about technology have a place and that we have to move forward. However, in talking with industry people about this, I have been assured by industry that they have no intention whatsoever of ensuring a mandatory human override option. And my concern is the following, that we like to think that GPS and technology and all these things are infallible. They're not. The more you over-plumb a system, the easier it is to mess up. And just in terms of real terms, we like to look on TV and think that war these days, because of GPS tomahawks and these airstrikes and everything else. According to the United Nations, about 1,240 folks have been killed, civilians have been killed, between 2009 and 2015 by coalition forces. And I can tell you personally, there is no military in the world that works harder to ensure we do not hurt innocent people. But technology is not, shall we say, perfect. Mm-hmm. And my question is, will you assure, and this is more for ODOT, will you assure that whatever industry may want — I do not have a fiduciary responsibility to industry, I have a fiduciary responsibility to citizen of Oregon — whatever industry may want, we ensure that there is some kind of override until we are absolutely dead certain that this stuff isn't going to kill more people by accident than it will help?
Jimmy, Representative Evans, those are the really important questions that need to be wrestled with. So as I was rereading the NHTSA policy last night, that one number jumped at me, 35,092. That's the number of people who were killed in car crashes in 2015, the last year for which we have data. 94% of those crashes were the result of human choice or error. So I quote frequently from Immanuel Kant, from the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing has ever been made. And that is very true. While we know that there is certainly no infallibility of computer systems, human beings are very fallible, with the ability for distraction and drunken driving and many other improper behaviors. So that said, yes, those are the questions that we're going to have to be wrestling with about that override function and what level of security and safety the federal government will require. That really will be largely a federal question as to how that plays out, because states do not have the regulatory authority generally within the interstate commerce of the nation to regulate automobiles in that sense.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much. We need to move on to our next panel, and I'd like to call up Mr. Roussa and Mr. Jones, please. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Brian Rosa. I'm the Executive Director for North America Government Relations for General Motors, and I sincerely appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today. Not many would have thought that self-driving vehicles would capture the imagination of the public as they had today. And once what we once thought was something that was far away, and I must confess, even members of the earlier panel, I think, have too long of a time frame for the deployment and development of this technology. It's quickly becoming a reality today. And I've got to kind of abandon my prepared testimony because I think it's important. I'm going to show a video here for you. And General Motors acquired a company in San Francisco over a year and a half ago called Cruise Automation. And we've paired their expertise and software experience with General Motors manufacturing and engineering expertise to build a fleet of autonomous vehicles. We have 70 vehicles today testing on the streets of San Francisco, Scottsdale, Arizona, and metropolitan Detroit. Now, these vehicles are electric Bolt, Chevrolet Bolt, AEVs, electric vehicles. Our AVs will be EVs. But I wanted to give you a perspective because I think the earlier panel maybe didn't do justice to where the technology is. So the video I'm about to show you is a time-lapse video of one of these vehicles navigating the streets of San Francisco. Now, there is a trained driver behind the wheel. But through this entire video, there are zero human takeovers. And I'm going to have Juanita Martinez from our team here tee this up and see if we can't make this work. So again, this is time elapsed. This is the streets of San Francisco. Again, you see the left-hand screen, there's the driver. And his hands are near the wheel, but not on the wheel. This vehicle is operating entirely autonomously during this drive. Navigating pedestrians, construction, traffic, pedestrians. Every time I watch this, I'm amazed. I think we'll cut it off there. I mean, a lot of it goes on. But from what you can see, this technology has come a long way. And again, I think that it's approaching us rapidly, and it's only going to accelerate. I wanted to speak a little bit. You know, for years as an automaker, we've committed resources to building our vehicles so that they're safer and so that the passengers are safe when there's a crash. The promise of this technology is that we may be able to avoid some of these crashes altogether. And I cite the data cited earlier about 94% of the fatalities on U.S. roads and highways today are committed by human error. 10% of those fatalities are distracted driving. 28% are impaired driving. 30% involve excessive speed. And again, the sad statistic that we deal with here is the leading cause of death in this country for adults and children aged 4 to 34 are automobile crashes. So while absolutely we have to ensure that these vehicles are absolutely safe before they're deployed, and we have a plan to do that. We're going to do that by testing these vehicles extensively, putting many miles on them in the scenario you've seen here with a safety driver. But frankly, our vehicles every day are improving, they're getting smarter, and they're getting better. We think that in addition to the promise of safety, you know, the other benefits, reduce congestion, emissions, land use in urban areas, and also, very importantly, providing access to transportation for those who need it most, particularly persons with disabilities or persons who live in underserved communities that might not have very good access to public transportation. We believe autonomous vehicles can really fill a void there. GM is all in this prospect. You're aware now of our acquisition of Cruise Automation. We've also made a major investment in Lyft, the ride-sharing company. And frankly, that's where we see this technology going first. We believe that ride-sharing, maybe even initially with a safety driver behind the wheel, is an ideal way to do this in a geo-fenced, dense urban area with the vehicles going over these same routes again and again, and in a slow speed, not on necessarily on the highways, but at more city speeds. We believe that allowing the public the option to experience this technology in a ride-sharing context is hugely important, because I think you've all seen the polling that shows the public is very, very skeptical of this technology and where it's at. So that's our approach at General Motors. And one of the reasons that I really want to focus on, and I'm really appreciative that the committee is undertaking a work group to look at legislation in this space, and we're going to fully participate in that work group, and we appreciate that. And I want to bring to your attention, we have are supporting some draft legislation, which I believe you have copied in your materials, that we believe provides a regulatory framework for the safe testing and deployment of autonomous vehicles. In fact, this draft legislation in your materials is significantly different than the legislation that was originally introduced as House Bill 3119. And the reason that is that legislatively across the country, this issue has developed significantly and is the result of hours and hours of stakeholder input and legislative meetings. The state of Michigan overwhelmingly adopted similar legislation in December of last year. Just this week on Monday, the governor of Georgia signed into law similar legislation to what you have in a draft form. In addition, the governor of Colorado has a bill on his desk to act on that is similar to this legislation. And late last night, the Tennessee legislature put its final touches on legislation that is similar to what I'm discussing. Three other states are acting on similar legislation: Texas, North Carolina, and Nevada. And briefly, let me give you kind of a summary of the key points of the draft legislation I'm referring to. First of all, it addresses the question that some have said is that we don't need changes in laws to deploy this technology. There are those that believe if the state doesn't specifically prohibit it, that it's allowed. Well, frankly, we disagree. The state laws clearly contemplate a human driver behind the wheel, and we believe the laws need to be addressed in a way that allows the vehicle or the automated driving system of the vehicle to undertake the driving tasks. That's the first thing that the legislation does. The second thing is that these vehicles must ensure that they're able and capable to meet all of the traffic rules of the state. Third, manufacturers of these vehicles have to certify that these vehicles comply with all applicable federal safety standards. And in addition, there are exemptions available federally that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration provides for self-driving vehicles. Those should qualify as well. And finally, these vehicles need to have adequate insurance. And the key thing that we think is that the law should specifically allow for this ride-sharing context that I've described. We believe, again, that through ride-sharing, these autonomous vehicles will really give the public an exposure to them and an acceptance of them as the technology is developed. So I'm going to kind of wrap it up here. I've kind of been all over the place, but I appreciate the opportunity. I hope you enjoyed the video. If you're really interested, there's another video that was done at night and also on the streets of San Francisco to show this technology navigating the streets at night. And one of the interesting things is it actually avoids a raccoon crossing the street. I didn't know they had raccoons in San Francisco, but apparently they do, and our car did not hit it. So please take a look at this. I appreciate the opportunity to be before you here today, and I'd be glad to take any questions you have.
We'll take some questions right now, if that's okay. Representative Evans has a question.
Thank you, Chair. The question, and I appreciate the point about 38,000, 50,000, however many it is a year that die because of human error. Humans have a lot of fallibility. Humans have a lot of challenges. That said, the automated side of the house has exposures that humans don't generally have. And again, I'm the guy that is not invited to parties because I think this way, so I understand it's probably not what you've been thinking. But if I wanted to cause chaos in the United States, I would find a way to hack these cars, and they would be my little toys to roll at people at high speeds. And the point I'm concerned about is right now today, people have a hard time securing their email.
Yeah.
How in the heck are we going to figure out a way to secure millions of vehicles moving around? How is that not an open invitation for some type of terror attack?
I think it's a great question, and what you framed up, I think, is in essence the cybersecurity problem. But I do have to preface my answer to say it's an issue with vehicles today. Our vehicles are very connected today, and vehicles today are used, unfortunately and sadly, in terrorist acts today in big trucks. So it's happening today. Vehicle hacking is happening today. So it's a problem that we clearly have to address, and the auto industry is working on it. In fact, one of the things that General Motors has done, we've actually created a high-level position in our company. We have a chief cybersecurity officer that reports to the highest levels of our company. In addition, we're part of something called an auto ISAC, and I don't know if you're familiar with what an ISAC is, but different industries have these, and the acronym, if I believe, stands for Information Sharing, Access, and Collaboration, and it's essentially we are a part of this with other automakers, and we share information on hacking events and how they were accomplished and how they're done, and it serves also as a liaison with law enforcement. So to answer your question, we absolutely have to solve that problem. We have to work on that problem, and there's more work to be done. However, to think that it's isolated to only autonomous vehicles, I would argue, you know, we have the same issues because our vehicles today are increasingly connected.
Thank you, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the last panel came up and said, you know, 5 to 15 years, you came up and showed us a video and said, hey, it's here. What is your opinion on when some of these other states are going to start adopting these programs? I mean, we just here in Oregon just allowed self-service gas pumping, you know, in the last year. So.
Well, I said, so far, you know, states that have taken action, Michigan has acted, Georgia's acted. I expect Colorado and Tennessee will follow soon. And there's a handful of other states that'll probably do it this year in their sessions. When is the technology going to arrive? I'm not allowed to give that answer. Unfortunately, I'm bounded a little bit for proprietary reasons. However, I will tell you, you know, in a ride-sharing context, in a geo-fenced area with the level 4 technology, I think it is going to be here much sooner than the 10-year horizon that was portrayed earlier. I think you can see this technology is really making rapid progress, and it's not just General Motors, but the other players, the tech companies, the other automakers. We're, you know, like I said, these vehicles are adding miles, and they're getting smarter and better every day.
Can I have a follow-up?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
So with smaller vehicles, you know, you can see there's a danger to that, just like Representative Evans said, but when we start talking about trucks and larger vehicles that can do, you know, potentially a lot more damage, do you see them being behind the curve 5 to 10 years?
You know, we haven't focused on large commercial trucks as part of our business, but I'm really not going to comment on where they are. But again, I'm going to turn back to the issue of human error. I mean, it's as big an issue in driving big rigs as it is driving cars. And I think to the point is that, you know, 94% of the fatalities, it's human error. And if the technology can do better than that, we need to find a way to accommodate it and encourage it, in my opinion.
Quick question about regulation. And you mentioned several states, but not California. And you're obviously here in San Francisco. How are you running these programs and pilot programs?
Sure. Well, California actually, I'm remiss, I didn't mention, they actually enacted a law, I believe, 1-8-2012.
Yes.
And, however, they have been undergoing a lengthy regulatory process that's gone, I think, on for more than 2 years now. The good news is they have a testing program that exists today. So, again, we're testing with a driver behind the wheel there. You're not allowed to deploy without a driver in California. But we believe with the recent rulemaking activity, in fact, a proposed rule that was heard, I believe, 2 or 3 weeks ago in California, they are providing a pathway to deployment without a human operator. So California is not there yet. They're there on testing. And they soon, however, will, I believe, when they complete this rulemaking, will have a pathway to deployment without a driver behind the wheel.
Thank you very much. Thank you for that answer. And Mr. Jones.
Great. Thank you. Chair Meek and members of the committee, my name is Eric Jones, and I'm a partner in the regulatory group at Venable LLP based in Washington, D.C. And I also serve as counsel to the Self-Driving Coalition for Safer Streets, and I'm pleased to submit testimony on behalf of the coalition here today. You're going to hear me say some of the same things that my partner here up here on the table said, but I want to make sure I share them so you can know the perspective of the coalition as well. The coalition was founded in April of last year by Ford Motor Company, Waymo, which is Google's self-driving car project, Lyft, Uber, and the Volvo Car Group. We are focused on enabling the safe and swift deployment and development of fully autonomous vehicles, which we commonly refer to as AVs. This cross-section of companies representing technology, automobile manufacturing, and transportation network companies demonstrates the widespread interest in developing this technology across different sectors. Despite their different backgrounds, the companies came together to form the coalition because of their commitment to bring the tremendous potential safety and mobility benefits of self-driving cars to consumers in the safest and swiftest manner possible. I understand that members of the committee would like to understand what the benefits of self-driving vehicles could be for Oregon, and you're going to hear me make some of the same points, but I want to make sure I share them. First and foremost, the coalition believes that fully autonomous vehicles could make our roads much more safe and more accessible. Data from the National Safety Council estimates that more than 40,000 Americans died in motor vehicle crashes last year alone. More frustrating is that we are seeing an upward trend in fatalities after enjoying years of significant reductions, and there's speculation that's likely related to all the distracted driving that's occurring because people are on their phones. The coalition believes that strongly that fully autonomous vehicles have the potential to significantly transform and advance the personal safety of passengers and other roadway users from what we are currently experiencing. An estimated 94% of all crashes are the result of a human decision, whether that's driving drunk, driving distracted, fatigued, or at excess speeds. Fully autonomous vehicles have the potential to dramatically reduce fatal traffic accidents because they remove human error from the driving process entirely. In addition to these potential safety benefits, autonomous vehicles hold the promise to greatly enhance mobility for the disabled and elderly. They would open up transportation options to those who currently do not have them and offer the opportunity for more independence. As autonomous vehicles are deployed, they also have the capability of improving productivity, which isn't something that has been discussed as much. For example, a commuter would be free to start their workday or work on other things while they're in the car rather than just spending a good chunk of their day driving to and from work. And finally, as a new technology, we believe that states which encourage the testing and deployment of the autonomous vehicles within their borders will likely position themselves to take advantage of the economic benefits that typically come from being incubators for innovation. I've been informed that members, and we've discussed this a little bit already today, but that members would like to better understand how automated vehicles will function in a quote-unquote non-automated world. This is a really good question, and I'm glad to answer it. And I think the video that was shown really shows what that's going to look like. The members of the coalition are not developing AVs in with the idea that they will be in a world where there's only autonomous vehicles. They have to be developed to match the driving conditions that humans experience today, and that includes other human drivers, that includes pedestrians, and it includes cyclists. And so the only way this will work and that we'll see adoption is if we don't have to do a wholesale change of our entire sort of driving infrastructure, but have these vehicles fit within the infrastructure that we have today. I also understand that committee members would like to know the coalition's perspective on testing and deployment of autonomous vehicles in the next 2 years. I think the coalition members have the perspective that we will continue to see testing and deployment. And I think the important point that we've been making, and we've been testifying across the country on these issues in states that are all, like Oregon, are looking at this, it's really going to come down to right now because while the technology is developing and it's getting there, it's still the development is in its at the beginning stages. And so what we're dealing with is what kind of regulatory hurdles could be put in place that will slow down the development in certain parts of the country. And so I guess what I would say is that question really depends upon what we're dealing with as far as what kind of how much time and effort is going to be involved in creating regulatory hurdles that could slow down the process. That's the technology is developing. Companies are ready to test and deploy. enjoy. And so we are just ensuring that, or we would like to see state legislatures set up dynamics where that can continue to occur rather than slowing it down. With that in mind, I think it's important to share the coalition's perspectives on the role for the states and the role for the federal government as you examine this issue. With respect to automated vehicles, the coalition's view does track the perspective of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration's Federal Automated Vehicles Policy, which was mentioned earlier. It was published last year, and that policy explains that NHTSA is responsible for setting and enforcing motor vehicle safety standards, investigating and managing remedies of defects and noncompliance, educating the public about motor vehicle safety, and issuing guidance regarding vehicle and equipment manufacturing. NHTSA is in charge of the safety of the vehicles themselves and what should be in the vehicle and what should not be in the vehicle, put a different way. And states, from the NHTSA's perspective, are responsible for licensing vehicle registration, traffic laws, insurance and liability, and, where applicable, safety inspections. The coalition strongly believes that states should not deviate from this jurisdictional balance, as state action outside these traditional roles would give rise to a patchwork of potentially state-specific vehicle performance and other requirements that would impede the deployment of autonomous vehicles. And that's what I was referring to earlier when about the timing of how this is going to develop. If there is that patchwork, that would certainly slow it down. It is our view that if Oregon does choose to take legislative or regulatory action with respect to AVs, such action should be premised on removing impediments to the safe testing or deployment of such vehicles and creating a pro-competitive environment and level playing field. And that's something we testified on earlier this year, and I think my understanding is we've made some progress on that front. We recommend that states concentrate on revising existing laws and regulations to comprehend autonomous vehicles. And I just want to say in closing that, you know, like GM, the members of the coalition are really appreciative of the fact that the members of this committee are taking the time to explore this issue. We do think it could dramatically alter our perception of what's considered safe when it comes to driving in this country. And we are more than happy to continue working with members of the committee to develop legislation that will work for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jones. And just want to check in with the committee. I'd like to save about, let's kind of budget 5 minutes for questions and answers with this panelist. And I'd like to start with Mr. Representative Vial.
Thank you, Chair Meek. Brian, I appreciate you going off script.
Sure.
And I appreciate the candor with which you kind of laid that out for us. If we were to look at a legislative solution that perhaps created limited allowances for jurisdictions like Portland with appropriate geofencing to do a level of testing, a level of deployment that they felt comfortable with. NHTSA's got its rule. You meet NHTSA's rule. The state says, okay, now we're going to let a jurisdiction participate in whatever fashion they feel comfortable, but we're not going to initially say driverless cars are per se okay in Oregon as long as NHTSA rules have been handled and as long as the rest of our laws are obeyed. I recognize that that does create some of this patchwork thing that we're perhaps trying to avoid, but is that a start that would at least allow us to participate in the technological advance here?
I think, you know, obviously we support a more broad approach, and I think that the problem that you'll run into is that the stakeholders involved also support a broader approach. But let's have that dialogue, and I think you're convening that stakeholder group. What are the concerns? Let's see what the, you know, what it is that we, you know, may be able to accomplish. I think the dialogue is important. We're committed to working the stakeholder process to explore that, to see what might work, what doesn't.
Okay, thanks.
Representative McLean.
First of all, I really appreciate the fact that the first panel was the first panel, and watching you guys in the audience was just hilarious, because it was like, hold on to my seat here. I go, what did they just say? I think it was real important for us to have, you know, that review that wasn't a manufacturer.
Sure.
And but I do appreciate as well the way you were able to come up and then give us your take on it. I do appreciate the fact that you gave us some very good guidance in your mind of what you need to make sure that we don't slow down innovation. But, you know, I thought it was pretty clear from the review of the U.S., you know, transportation material, when they looked at the state model and what the federal government, we all get what the federal government's supposed to do, and they deal with the safety. But there was a good list there that they talked about registration and licensing and insurance, and that those things, you know, are really, those are state provisions that we need to think about. And so I'm really looking forward to the work group, and I really want us to make sure we understand that, as far as you're concerned, we need to get started if we don't want to stop you in your tracks. And so I'm going to get to talk to you guys a lot more, but thank you, and I appreciate the information today.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. And I'm going to call up our next set of panelists, Mr. Fugate, Mr. Rose, and Mr. Stranigan. If you're all here today, please come up. And while you're on your way up, just have the first gentleman ready to go. And we'd like to keep this to about 20 minutes. And if you can be as expedient with your presentation and leave a little room for some questions and answers. I'm sorry, Lieutenant Fugate. I'm sorry.
good morning, chairs, members of the committee. My name is Bill Fugate. I'm a captain with the Oregon State Police. I'm currently legislative coordinator for the agency, and I do have years of experience working the road, including transportation safety issues. As mentioned to this committee before, at the Oregon State Police, we work with our partners at ODOT routinely to ensure the safety of travelers on Oregon's highways. At this point right now, you know, the information is pretty new to us. There's still a lot of research to be done. And talking with the chiefs and sheriffs, there's a lot of questions to be had on the enforcement of any statutes that are currently on the books. So there'll definitely have to be some consideration on, as mentioned before, clarification on some definitions of drivers and other under the Oregon Vehicle Code. So at this point, just we're welcome to participate in any committee, with, you know, that's or not committee, but work group that this committee deems necessary to talk about those enforcement issues that may come up as the legislation changes or is considered. So,
thank you very much. We'll leave room for some questions in a little bit here. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michael Rose. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I've spoken with many members of the committee previously. One of the members of the committee mentioned that trial lawyers and the courts are the last line of protection for people injured by unsafe products or conduct. Our goals are first and foremost to promote safety. And if unsafe products are rushed to the market, then we have the tools to protect individuals and hold those accountable, responsible for the harm that they caused. Right now, the federal guidelines address some aspects of the technology, as we've discussed previously with other members who have presented to this committee. The issues of how to enact this statewide has been really left kind of open. We've seen a flurry of proposed legislation in Oregon and other states, and I've been reviewing these proposed legislations and really looking at three primary features that align with the guidelines that NHTSA has promulgated. And the first of these is the permitting process. Essentially, these new technologies are coming, and these are we don't have much experience. They're like new drivers that we don't have any experience about how they're actually acting on our roads, how safe they are, and it's almost like giving a driver's license to a new driver. We go through a permitting process. We go through a probationary process. What we want to see here is that that process happens and that there's transparency, that a reporting of incidents happens, that the state has the ability to review incidents as they occur and evaluate whether the permit should be continued or should be modified. Second, collecting, preserving, and reporting data. If there's an incident that happens, if the state is not aware of it, if the regulating body is not aware of it, the state's going to have a very difficult time in determining whether or not these vehicles are operating safely on our roads. The same thing if there's an incident. One of our big concerns when a party is harmed in one of these events is that they actually have access to the data so they can find out what happened. We have a broad patchwork quilt of how we determine fault, how we determine insurance in this state. And if we lack the data, if we lack the information of what went wrong, injured parties are going to have a very difficult time in deciding where fault lies. Enforcement from the police is going to be very difficult if they can't determine where in this process things went wrong. Lastly is liability coverage and how we treat autonomous vehicles. Are these to be treated like a product under the law? Are they to be treated like a car as far as how we insure them? And this is probably the most crucial question for our end is what kind of comprehensive scheme is going to apply. We've got in one particular vehicle, as we're talking about the levels of automation from 0 to 5, we may go through 0 to 5 in the same vehicle on the same trip. Are we going to have different liability, different insurance that covers different parts of the same trip on the same vehicle? It's a big concern of ours that there may be gaps in coverage and liability. There's no such thing as a free lunch. If somebody is harmed during this rollout process, as everybody's rushing to market to get their product out there, if somebody is harmed, if somebody is injured, who's going to be covering that? Is it going to fall back on private insurance? Is it going to be uncovered and the state has to step in and take care of health insurance? Or is it going to fall onto our emergency rooms to cover people who are hurt and there is no insurance or coverage? There are different schemes as well that relate to determining who is liable in a product. In Oregon, we have strict liability, so that the person who is injured is not the one who is left trying to figure out what went wrong in this manufacturing process or design process. In the regular motor vehicle context, we have insurance on every car, and we have different insurance coverage for common carriers that are coming across state lines. We have all of those taken care of right now. These vehicles, we have no information about how they're going to be treated. We briefly discussed mass transit during the early parts of this presentation. It is certainly one of the big concerns that we have, that vehicles are going to be traveling together to take advantage of slipstreaming on our highways. These are going to be vehicles that are massive. We may have lines of many, many vehicles together. Some of these vehicles may include public transportation or buses or other types of vehicles. And our big concern is while this is being rolled out, we don't leave a lot of people exposed to liability where there simply isn't enough coverage. There are a lot of different schemes that have been promoted both in mass transit, in interstate transit, and in other contexts that might be more similar, like airline industries, where there's now a hybrid system of liability where you have strict liability up to a certain amount, and then after that you have individual proof of harm or individual proof of liability. Right now we're just starting this process. We don't exactly know what form these vehicles are going to take, how they're going to be operated on our road, and how they're even going to be operated on a particular trip. What we're really concerned about is that while this is being rolled out, we don't expose people and our property to a lot of harm that can be avoided. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gary Strandigan with Liberty Mutual Insurance. In a previous life, I was an aircraft accident investigator at Boeing, and my specialty was primary flight control systems. Thankfully, I never had to go on site to investigate an accident, but I was a black box guy, so we were all about the data to figure out what happened? And so from that's the central question from the insurance standpoint is, you know, will we have access to that data so we can get to the bottom of what went wrong, if anything went wrong with the autonomous systems? And the reason that's important for us is because it's foundational to our system of liability in the USA. It's all about responsibility. Liability should hinge on responsibility. And so determining responsibility for any damage or to property or lives is really central. So those comments are more directed towards when these cars are fully deployed in the marketplace, not so much for testing. So there are two different topics that you're considering today, right? You're considering, you know, what needs to happen so that you can test these things, and what's the environment going to look like when they're adopted. And by the way, I'd like to note that Liberty Mutual's mission is to help people lead safer, more productive lives. And it's been noted extensively, I think, that humans don't have a terrific safety record behind the wheel. And that's why there's so much energy being pushed towards this, because you're seeing an interesting confluence. The technology is developing very quickly. They see investors and others see a great opportunity to make society better. And so it makes sense that this is all happening now, and we applaud it. We're going to be working with you and others on how that liability system takes shape, so that we can properly assign responsibility for accidents when those occur. I could get into some other stuff. I could tell you all sorts of great stories about aircraft accidents, but I don't think you're interested in that.
Well, we probably have some questions, though, if you've finished, and start with Representative Vial.
Well, Gary, I appreciate the mission statement of Liberty, but my experience as a trial lawyer is that insurance companies are in the business to collect premium and deny claims. And the reality of that as a function of what we're doing here, as in the legislative stuff, is that we've got to frame these insurance questions in a way that aren't so technically sliced that denial of claims is something that then Mr. Rose and his colleagues are grappling with from the beginning. Have you investigated, or do you have any models for other jurisdictions that have faced this question and come up with solutions so far?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vial, the insurance industry is just beginning to grapple with how this is going to look. It doesn't seem to me that our liability system needs wholesale changes. But perhaps some tweaks around the edges are in order, and we're happy to work with plaintiffs' lawyers and anybody else to come to an agreeable system.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I wonder if we couldn't impose upon – well, let me put it this way. I think the industry, which I apologize somewhat for my flippant remarks, but the reality is that this is a big...
It's an effective talking point.
This is a big industry, and it's a critical industry in how our society functions. The idea that we spread risk and that we have means and institutions like yours that help us to do that is incredibly important. I almost think this is the pivot point of this whole question in deploying autonomous vehicles. How do we get our liability risks appropriately allocated? And for that reason, I guess I'm asking whether the insurance industry feels that same importance in this whole question, and if you think they're prepared to step up and really help us with this.
Well, I can only speak on behalf of Liberty Mutual, but I can assure you that a great deal of energy and thought is being devoted to this subject area. Because it's going to disrupt the insurance industry. Because the roadways will be safer, there will be it's anticipated that there will be fewer accidents. And over the course of time, that means that insurance prices will go down. Mm-hmm. The market will shrink relative to the improved safety correspondingly. So the shrinking market, some liability we anticipate will move over to manufacturers. And whether we want that to be a product liability situation or whether there's a new set of products developed for manufacturers to address those issues for them, those are, I think, questions that we're struggling with. And there'll be, I think, discussions in open venues with trial lawyers, insurance commissioners, and everybody else to make sure that we have a system that fairly assigns responsibility.
I'm feeling some real personal urgency on this issue, so I appreciate the industry's willingness to step up.
Thank you, Vice Chair Vile. Representative McLean.
On that same issue, you know, of liability, as I sat here, I kept writing down all the people that are going to be involved, and I was very interested in your comments about gaps. And so we've got an embedded product. We've got the manufacturer of the embedded product. We've got a possible TNC company that might be helping with deployment. We've got then a fleet owner that could be one of those above, or it could be somebody else. Somebody else bought a fleet, you know, for deployment. And so that's at least, you know, four distinct folks that could be involved in that liability scenario. And so as Representative Vile said, I think what we're looking for, at least in the work group, is, you know, we know that insurance companies can make new product, but we want to make sure that any new product that is made before all the safety comes, that it covers all of the potential or possibility that is out there as far as how this system is actually going to function, And also, there's two systems. There's the testing system, and then there's the deployment system that's been mentioned in different ways, you know, throughout the presentations today. So I really appreciate your comments. And, sir, you sat on the ODOT committee?
Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, no, I was not the person on the committee.
But there were some law enforcement folks on that committee, correct?
Correct.
So you folks have some opportunity to weigh in with some questions at that committee, and you know, I'm sure we'd be interested in the short, you know, in that small work group too.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Representative McLean. And my question is for Captain Fugate. How do you pull over an autonomous vehicle?
I was actually thinking the same thing. I just hope they pull over and turn the red and blues on. So hopefully that email is built in, you know.
Yeah, make sure we talk to the manufacturers and get a button on there that you can pull them over. My question, I have more of a comment and a statement. There are recreational drivers out there right now, and that has just been, you know, I love to drive myself, and I know two gentlemen here that are motorcycle advocates, you know, and do you guys potentially feel threatened that you're not going to be able to be out there riding your motorcycle in the future?
You know, I'm just a little bit nervous about that scenario that involves the plastic sack blowing across the freeway and me following that vehicle.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll work that out.
So I'm just curious, we're talking about the, you know, eventual automation of vehicles, that they're all kind of programmed together. They all see one object at front, and they all slow down together. Are we leaving, you know, opportunity for recreational drivers still, or is that going to be eventually outlawed? No answer.
It may not be the right panel.
I can, sure, I can comment on that. the consumers in the USA have global power, and they demonstrate that. If there's a market, there's going to be products.
No, I just hate to see our regulations get to the point that it's unsafe to have, you know,
exactly.
Drivers behind the vehicle. So,
Mr. Chair, if I may, I've actually seen this point raised from a socioeconomic perspective as well. As these are being rolled out in autonomous situations, it's going to affect the urban, and the well-to-do are going to be the first implementers. And frequently, the people left who are controlling their own vehicles are going to be the laborers, the workers, the people who can't afford it, outlying communities. So it is a very important concern how we address these issues as they're being rolled out. Are we going to be protecting only those that are the ones that are the most affluent rather than the people in the outlying communities that really do depend on driving every day in reliable and cheap transportation? And this system as it's coming into place is going to be a hybrid system for quite some time. And there is a very big concern that we're going to leave behind people who need the most protection.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody. Oh, well, I'm sorry. I created some questions. Yes, sir, Representative.
I just want to say to that point, I actually would like to advocate that the cities get this first. Keep it away from Polk County as long as possible. Fine with me.
Is that it? Anybody else? Yeah, Representative Vile.
Well, I just want to express gratitude to all those who took time to prepare and come and testify today. And beginning tomorrow afternoon, we're going to begin working on this. I'm committed to really not just sitting around and talking about it, but actually get some things on paper, get some movement, make some progress on this. But I think the questions that have been raised today make it clear that we've got a lot of work to do. And I hope that all those that have been inclined to participate will come with their work boots on. Again, very much appreciated.
Yes, thank you, Vice Chair Bob. Thank you, all the panelists that came today for this informational hearing on autonomous vehicles, and I'm going to be closing that informational hearing right now. Thank you very much, and I'm going to be opening up a work session on Senate Bill 344A. Clerk, read the
bill. I'll just make some comments. Chair Meek, members of the committee, Senate Bill 344. Requires snowmobiles and certain all-terrain vehicles to cross a highway in an intersection of more than 100 feet from an intersection, establishes the all-terrain vehicle access routes advisory committee, and directs the Oregon Transportation Commission to designate all-terrain vehicle access routes throughout Oregon in consultation with the advisory committee. You'll recognize this as House Bill 2910, sponsored by Representative Barreto. This is sponsored by Senator Ferrioli. You have an amendment in front of you, the A2, that deletes the clause limiting all-terrain vehicle access route to counties with a population less than 20,000. So this will make Senate Bill 344 essentially the very same as House Bill 2910.
Brought.
Very good. I'd like to ask Representative Barreto to tell us a little bit about this and if he's in favor of this.
Yeah, I'm in favor of this. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the exact same bill that we passed out of committee previously. The bill that we passed out of here went to the floor, went over to transportation over on the Senate. I talked with Senator Beyer last week and said, you know, we're running this one here through. We'll just go ahead and run this through. They'll concur over there, he said. And so he's not running the bill on that side. So I just appreciate and thank you for running it through here.
Great. Okay, very good. Thank you. Do you have any comments or discussion? Then Vice Chair Vile.
Chair Meek, I move to adopt the A2 amendments dated 4/26/17.
Vice Chair Vile moves to adopt the A2 amendment dated 4/26/17. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? And so adopted.
Gavel. There you go. Chair Meek, I move Senate Bill 344 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Vile moves Senate Bill 344 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Barreto?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative McClain?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Excused.
Vice Chair Meek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Miles?
Aye.
Now, Representative Wilson is back in the room.
Representative Wilson on Senate Bill 344 having a vote.
Aye. Okay, motion passes. I'd like to assign a carrier. Representative Barreto, would you like to be the carrier?
I'd be glad to.
Very good. Representative Barreto will be the carrier for Senate Bill 344A, and I will close the work session on 344A. And any other further discussion? And then I will close this House committee on and adjourn this meeting on transportation policy. Thank you, everybody, for your time today.
I'll
drive this meeting on transportation policy. Thank you, everybody, for your time today.